In the longest talk in the series, Dr. Martos discusses the history of the Eucharistic liturgy, or the Mass, and of the history of the Eucharistic elements, the bread and wine, which are commonly referred to as the Blessed Sacrament. Over the centuries, the Mass has evolved from being a full meal with bread and wine to being merely a symbolic meal to being an elaborate liturgical ceremony with many prayers, readings, psalms, and hymns in addition to the consecration and communion. Moreover, just as the form of Eucharistic worship changed over the centuries, so also the Christian understanding of the Eucharist or Eucharistic theology has varied over the centuries. In recent years, the liturgical renewal has again introduced changes into the way the Catholics worship on Sundays, and as Dr. Martos points out, this has led to changes in the way that Catholics understand both the meaning of the Mass and the meaning of the Blessed Sacrament.
The Eucharist is such a complex sacrament that before talking about its history, it is necessary to say a few words of introduction. First of all, the word Eucharist covers both what Catholics have traditionally called the Mass and what is traditionally called Communion. That is, the Eucharist as a sacrament is both a sacramental action and a sacramental object. And the history of the sacrament is made somewhat complex by the fact that it is really the interwoven history of two different yet closely related sacraments. Even though Catholics are more used to calling the consecrated bread and wine the sacrament, the Blessed Sacrament, and the Mass, or the liturgy in which it is consecrated, the sacrifice of the Mass. Secondly, the theology of the Eucharist, at least the traditional theology, is filled with ideas which lasted much longer than the religious experience out of which they arose, with the result that these ideas then have to be reinterpreted in order to fit the later religious experience. For example, we speak of the Eucharistic liturgy as a meal. Now, actually, for the first generations of Christians, the Eucharist, or as it was called then, the Lord's Supper, was a meal, a real meal, which also included a blessing and sharing of bread and wine. Since then, however, the real meal has been dropped, and it is only by way of metaphor or analogy that we speak of Eucharistic worship as a meal which is spiritually rather than physically nourishing. But what happens when our experience at Sunday Mass is regularly not spiritually nourishing? Is it still truthful to call it a meal? We also speak of Eucharistic liturgy as a sacrifice. Again, this way of talking about it is quite ancient, and it goes back to times when ritual sacrifices of animals and other foods were common. Now, properly speaking, Christians didn't offer bread and wine as sacrifices to God. But to explain to non-Christians what they were doing during their weekly worship, they used the metaphor of sacrifice taken from pagan culture around them. Well, the Mass still is not a sacrifice in the ancient and authentic sense of that term, and so we can legitimately ask, is it still helpful to describe what we are doing in our Eucharistic worship using this ancient religious metaphor? Finally, the scriptures and other early Christian writings attest to the fact that the first Christians had a vivid sense of the presence of the risen Christ in their midst when they were commemorating the Lord's Supper. Eventually, this got to be spoken of theologically as the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. But over the centuries, the tendency has been to assert that this is something other than an experienced presence, and to assume that it is something like a physical presence even. Today, however, we can ask, is it still legitimate to speak of the Lord's presence in a special way during the liturgy when people don't really have a sense of His presence? In short, there is a tendency in all of sacramental theology, but especially in Eucharistic theology, to repeat words that were once spoken and written about the liturgy because they illuminated people's experience of Eucharistic worship, but to wrench them out of their experiential context and to give them a sort of objective, impersonal meaning. It's a little like biblical literalism or fundamentalism. which is a practice of taking the words of Scripture literally when they were not meant by their authors to be taken literally, or taking them out of the context in which they were originally written. In Catholicism, and especially in our sacramental theology, we tend to be literalists of a different sort. Perhaps we could call it liturgical fundamentalism. But just as Scripture scholars over the past 25 years have helped us to see that the truth in such biblical narratives as the story of Adam and Eve remains valid, even though it is not a literal account of the creation and fall of a single man and woman, so also liturgical scholars today are helping us to see that the truth of liturgical affirmations remains valid, even if we do not take them literally. However, to uncover the sometimes non-literal truth of the liturgy, it is necessary to learn more about the historical situations in which the traditional doctrines were first formulated. We are as historically certain as we are about any other fact in ancient history, such as the building of Solomon's temple or the death of Julius Caesar, that Jesus had a last important meal with his close followers shortly before his death. Tradition has it that this was a Jewish Passover supper, but here our historical certainty begins to waver. The gospel accounts do not all agree that it was a Passover meal, but only that it was a meal close to the Jewish feast of Passover. Tradition also has it, and this is recorded in the Gospels, that Jesus said the words, "This is my body, this is my blood," over the bread and wine used at that meal. But again here, historical certainty begins to falter when we try to pin down exactly what Jesus meant when he said those words. Some Christians, mostly Protestant, have proposed that they should be taken figuratively or metaphorically, in the same way that Jews were accustomed to giving symbolic meanings to the special foods that they used at their ritual meals, such as the Passover meal. Other theologians, mostly Catholic, have insisted that these words should be taken literally and realistically, meaning that Jesus intended to actually change the bread and wine into his body and blood. Today, however, a growing number of Catholic theologians, including Edward Skillebeck, Bernard Cook, and Joseph Powers, have suggested that both of these traditional and somewhat polemical positions are a bit too simple, that the truth of the matter is not either or, not that the bread and wine were either symbolically his body and blood or that they are really his body and blood, but rather that the truth is both and, that in symbolically designating these special foods as himself, Jesus changed their real meaning and significance and hence what they really were for those who shared them in a meal that commemorated his death and resurrection. In other words, it seems historically more likely that the first followers of Jesus, and these are the people who remembered and recounted the events of the Last Supper for decades before they were written down as part of the Gospels, it seems historically more likely that these first Christians took the words of Jesus not just symbolically, not just literally, but both, which is to say, they took them sacramentally. In the weeks and months and years that followed the Last Supper, the early Christians recalled what Jesus said and did with the bread and wine, and through that retelling of that memorable event and through the sharing of those special foods, the risen Lord became experientially present to them. This is what made the Lord's Supper such an important form of worship for them, and it is hard to specify today, 20 centuries later, whether it was the bread and wine, the remembering of the Last Supper, or the sharing of these foods with each other that was the key element for them. Just speaking historically, however, it seems unlikely that the early Christians focused their attention specifically on the bread and wine the way that medieval and modern Catholics later did. For they did not say that Christ was present in the bread and wine, but in the breaking of the bread and the sharing of the wine. That is, it was the whole ritual activity which included the blessing and eating of these special foods that was the sacrament of Christ's presence for them, and through which they came to experience his presence in their midst. Within a few generations, however, the Lord's Supper evolved from being a full meal which included bread and wine to being a ritual meal of only bread and wine, prefaced by scripture readings and a sermon. The reasons for this development are not entirely clear, but probably an important one was that as the size of Christian communities got larger, it became more and more difficult to get everyone into a single home. In those days, there were no church buildings yet, to sit down for a full dinner. But it was still possible to gather the whole community standing around the single table for prayer and worship. Now, a table as such is not unlike an altar, and in both Jewish and pagan sacrifice rituals, prayers were said around foods on an altar. Today, when we hear the word sacrifice, we often envision one particular kind of sacrifice, the burnt offering. In ancient times, however, that was only one type of sacrifice. The word sacrifice itself comes from Latin words sacrum facere, meaning to make holy. And the essence of sacrifice in ancient religions was not to offer something edible up to God. Rather, the essence was the making holy or sacred certain foods with which people were able, or at least supposed, to identify themselves. That is, in offering this special food to God, people mentally or psychologically identified themselves with it, and in doing so, they offered themselves to God. Usually, part of the food thus blessed was symbolically given to God by burning it, burying it, throwing it in a river, or more simply, by donating it to the temple. The rest of the food, however, was symbolically returned by God to the givers, who shared the blessed food in a sacred meal, in which they acknowledged having gotten themselves back, so to speak, from God, and experienced in the sharing of food something of God's mercy and generosity. With this as a background, then, it is easy to understand how and why the early Christians came to describe what they were doing at this symbolic meal, called the Lord's Supper, as a sacrifice of some sort. In their weekly worship, they offered themselves to God, and the focus and vehicle for their doing this was the bread and wine that Jesus had identified with himself on the day before he offered himself to God in his death on the cross. Moreover, Jesus' death was not the last chapter in his life. He also returned as the one resurrected by God to his disciples, and ever since then, those who believed in him experienced his resurrected presence when they joined themselves through bread and wine with Jesus' self-offering to the Father. So, once again, there was a parallel to the ancient conception of sacrifice and the sacrificial meal. Just as people received back from God what had been offered to him in sacrifice, so also Christian people received back from God what had been offered to him on Calvary. It was not long, therefore, before Christians began interpreting their Eucharistic worship using the metaphor of sacrifice, because in a way it was like the sacrifices which they were accustomed to from their Jewish and pagan backgrounds, in which people identified themselves with sacred food which was offered to God, usually in thanksgiving, and the word Eucharist, remember, in Greek means to give thanks, and in which they received back God's blessing through the sacrament of the shared food and experienced his care and concern for them. Finally, the use of the sacrifice metaphor for understanding the Eucharistic action was founded to some extent on those New Testament passages which interpreted Christ's death as a sacrificial offering to God. But it is important to recognize that at this early period in the Church's history, Eucharistic worship was not viewed as a sacrifice in the same way that it was seen later in the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, it would be understood as an unbloody sacrifice which represented Christ's bloody sacrifice on the cross and which was offered by the priest on behalf of the church. Here in the patristic era, the idea was rather that priest and people joined themselves to Christ's offering of himself to the Father. And so it was sacrificial in nature, not because it represented Christ's death, but because it symbolized their own offering of themselves to God in union with Christ. By the second century, Christian Sunday worship had developed a general rhythm or pattern which formed a structure for individual variations and later developments. It began with readings and responses, selections from the Bible or words from other inspired sources, and an explanation or exhortation from the leader of the community. This was followed by an offering of gifts and prayers, gifts from the less fortunate in the community, and prayers of thanksgiving and petition from the people assembled. Finally, there was the memorial or communion, the remembrance of what Jesus said and did at the Last Supper, and the sharing of Eucharistic bread and wine. In the dark days of Roman persecution, such a simple Eucharistic service might take 15 or 20 minutes, because Christians couldn't risk lengthy gatherings in each other's homes. But after Christianity was first legalized in the 4th century and 70 years later officially approved by the Roman government, Christians could gather in large numbers for longer periods of time, and so their simple Eucharistic meals developed into elaborate ceremonies of corporate worship. It is here, in the 4th century, for the first time, that we can legitimately speak of Eucharistic liturgies. Liturgy comes from a Greek word meaning public work or public service. Yet still, throughout this period of development, Christian worship retained its early basic three-part structure of reading, offering, and the sharing of bread and wine. Some liturgists today look back at this period as the high point of liturgical development in ancient Christianity, and certainly there is something to this view. The simple Eucharistic service was greatly enriched with ceremonial symbolism. It was during this period that much of what we associate with Eucharistic worship came into the picture: special vestments and altar vessels, public processions and the singing of hymns, the ceremonial use of candles, incense, and so on. Also, in the patristic liturgies, both the people and their religious leaders were involved together in a corporate act of public worship, so that there was full participation in the Eucharist. One indication of this is the fact that in Rome, the language of the liturgy was changed from Greek to Latin, as Latin began to replace Greek as the common language of the people. Finally, the patristic liturgies represented a high point in Christian worship because a number of them were composed by bishops who were both brilliant theologians and skilled liturgists, fathers of the church such as Basil the Great and John Chrysostom, whose liturgies are still used in Eastern Orthodox Christianity. To be fair, however, we have to admit that the picture was not altogether rosy. The elaborateness of the liturgy meant that often people were not personally and intimately involved in a communal act of worship, but they began to perceive themselves as spectators at a priestly act of worship. An example of this is that as time went on, the ceremonies and the songs became more complicated, and special people had to be trained to perform the functions around the altar and to do the singing or chanting. And so, as time went on, the average Christian played a smaller and smaller role in the weekly public liturgy. Not only this, but by the middle of the 5th century, Christians were no longer going to communion every time that the Eucharist was celebrated. To some extent, this was due to the fact that the notion of the Mass as a sacrifice was becoming more predominant, but now this was beginning to be taken to mean that the priest offered the sacrifice while the people watched, and since he offered the sacrifice, only he needed to partake of the sacrificial food, that is, the consecrated bread and wine. Probably the major cause of the drop in communion, however, was the fact that during the 4th century, a great theological debate had arisen about Christ, about his nature and his relation to God the Father. Was he just a human being? Was he really God, just appearing to be human, or what? A number of general church councils, ecumenical councils, we would call them today, met to debate and to try to settle the issues raised by this debate, and to combat the heresy called Arianism, named after a theologian named Arius who denied the divinity of Christ. Bishops and writers during the patristic period put great emphasis on Christ's being the second person of the Blessed Trinity and on his being equal to God the Father. These theological ideas, of course, found their way into the prayers of the liturgy, into the sermons that were preached, and even into church art, such as the great mosaics which depict Christ as a majestic and all-powerful God. And once this happened, people began to have second thoughts about going to communion, which meant receiving the body and blood of Christ, which meant, in effect, coming into contact with Almighty God himself. It was easy not to feel worthy of such close contact with the divine and to limit one's reception of communion to those times when one had made a special effort to become spiritually prepared for it. The 6th and 7th centuries mark a transition period in both European history and the history of Western Christianity. The Roman Empire had fallen under the weight of successive invasions and migrations by Germanic tribes from the north, and it was the beginning of what is sometimes called the Dark Ages. Christian bishops, however, since by their position and training they had authority and education, the bishops of this period sought to respond to this situation as best they could. As we shall see when we get to talking about holy orders, they took on the responsibility of being civil as well as ecclesiastical rulers. But, as leaders of the church, they of course felt they had an obligation to support the conversion and the Christianization of these pagan barbarians. As we saw in the section on baptism, the missionaries who were sent to perform this task brought with them a stripped-down version of Christian initiation which had been developed for the baptism of infants. And, as a matter of fact, somewhat the same thing happened with regard to the Eucharist. These missionary priests, traveling alone and in small groups, could not hope to celebrate a liturgy such as the elaborate bishops' liturgies in southern Europe. They did not have the clerical assistance they needed, and the people, of course, could not help either, partly because they had just been baptized and hardly understood what the Eucharist was about, and partly because they did not understand Latin, which was kept as the official language of the church. The result was that the liturgy, or the Mass, Missa as it was called in Latin, was often celebrated by a priest with no servers. He had to recite both his parts and the people's parts. And sometimes priests even had to say Mass with no congregation if he was on a journey and had not yet reached Christian territory. In this way, then, the more common form of Eucharistic worship in Europe became what was later called a low mass, a Eucharist celebrated by a single priest in Latin in a low voice with his back to the congregation, while the bishop's liturgy developed into what was called a high mass, a Eucharist by a number of clergy and other helpers with certain parts chanted by the celebrant and sung by a choir. The basic parts of the early Christian Eucharist were still there, readings, offering, and communion. But now there was no explanation of the readings, no sermon. Now the offering was made by the priest rather than by the people. And now only the priest regularly received communion, as had become the practice in the late patristic period. Of course, there were still no standard liturgical books during this period, and so prayers were added which reflected the beliefs and attitudes of medieval Christians, such as protestations of unworthiness and requests for God's mercy, and such as prayers to Mary and the saints asking for their intercession. And along with this, church art and architecture also developed a more Germanic European style into what is today called Gothic architecture, with its towering, lengthy cathedrals, which set the altar way at one end so that what the priest said and did could almost not be seen and heard, and with its statues and stained glass windows, which gave the people something to look at and learn from while Mass was going on. Since the priest was so far away during the Mass, he held up the host for all to see after the consecration, and later a bell was rung to call their attention to the fact. Since people didn't receive communion very often, unused hosts were kept in a special box called a tabernacle, and people themselves began to perceive their role in Christian worship as one of coming to church to adore Christ in the consecrated bread and wine, either during the Mass or between Masses in the tabernacle. You could say that the emphasis in the medieval Christian worship was exactly the reverse of what it had been in the early days of the Lord's Supper. Instead of participating in the ritual, the people now watched the ritual being performed for them. Instead of offering themselves, as Jesus had done as an offering to the Father, the people now offered Christ in consecrated bread and wine as a sacrifice to God. And instead of experiencing the presence of the risen Christ in the Eucharistic act of sharing bread and wine, the people now focused their attention on the host and on the chalice when they were lifted up for their gazing adoration and experienced the divine presence there in the consecrated bread and wine. This is why, when civilization began to return to normal, when in the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries, roads were rebuilt, trade was resumed, cities grew larger, and schools were established, the schoolmen or scholastics in the medieval universities focused much of their theological attention on the consecrated Eucharist, on the sacramental objects rather than the sacramental action when it came to discussing the Mass and explaining what happened at the Mass. In the 11th century, for example, a schoolman named Berengar in the French city of Tours proposed that during the Mass the bread and wine became symbols of Christ's body and blood. But this theory was unacceptable to the majority of churchmen who took the words of consecration, "This is my body, this is my blood," literally. It was also unacceptable in the light of ordinary Christian experience of divine presence during the Mass, for that experience was focused on the host and the chalice, and people could find no reason why they should experience God's presence in the consecrated bread and wine unless he was really and truly present there, unless they had really become, as the words of the Mass said, and as the scriptures seem to indicate, the body and blood of Christ. This was what might be called a physical interpretation of the Eucharist. During the 12th and 13th centuries, a somewhat different explanation was developed, which became the common Christian belief in Catholic doctrine, and it is what we might call a metaphysical interpretation of the Eucharist. Metaphysics is that branch of philosophy which has to do with the nature of reality, not just physical reality, but all of reality. Now, the scholastics, you may recall, borrowed many of their metaphysical concepts from the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle, whose works were discovered by medieval intellectuals after centuries of having been lost or forgotten. Some of Aristotle's basic metaphysical categories were being and non-being, essence and existence, matter and form, substance and accidents. We have already discussed briefly the distinction between matter and form and how these notions were applied to the sacraments, the matter being the external, visible ritual, and the form being its essential but non-visible meaning. With regard to the Eucharist, however, the scholastics found it necessary to utilize Aristotle's distinction between substance and accidents, a substance being basically something which exists, an existing individual reality of any sort, and accidents, so-called, being the technical term for its various qualities, size, shape, color, weight, and so on. Now, according to the Aristotelian way of analyzing things, a substance could change in one of two ways. It could change substantially, in which case both the substance and its appearance is changed, as when wood burns and turns into smoke and ashes, or it could change, as the scholastics would have said, accidentally, in which case the substance remained the same, but only its accidents or appearances changed, as when a person grows from childhood to adulthood or even more simply, as when a house is painted, it just changes its color. Armed with this general metaphysical analysis of change, therefore, the scholastic theologians took a look at the Mass and asked, what kind of change is it when the bread and wine are changed into the body and blood of Christ? Is it a substantial change or an accidental change? Well, in some ways it was a substantial change. It was a real change from one thing into another. The words of the liturgy said as much, the words of the New Testament said equivalently the same, and their religious experience also testified to the fact that during the Mass, the Eucharistic bread and wine were changed into Christ's body and blood. On the other hand, in one way, it was unlike all other substantial changes, for whenever anything else changed substantially, its qualities or appearances also changed. But in the case of the Eucharist, after the change, the body and blood of Christ still had the appearances of bread and wine. Because, then, this kind of change was unique, the scholastic theologians gave it a unique name, transubstantiation, meaning that in this special case, the substantial reality changed, although the accidents or appearances did not. There were some other theories developed along slightly different lines, the most notable of which was consubstantiation, meaning that after the words of consecration were spoken, both the substance of bread and wine and the substance of Christ's body and blood were present together on the altar. But the theory of consubstantiation had few adherents, at least in the early Middle Ages, and gradually transubstantiation came to be regarded as not only a good philosophical explanation for the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, but the official Catholic position and Church doctrine on the subject. With reference to what we have seen earlier about other scholastic categories for interpreting the sacraments, we find in the Eucharist the primary application of the philosophical distinction between sacramentum tantum and res tantum and sacramentum et res. In fact, it was in connection with the Eucharist, after wrestling with Berengar's problem about whether the consecrated elements were a sign of Christ's body and blood or really Christ's body and blood, that scholastic theologians working in Paris overcame the problem posed by the double distinction between sign and reality by introducing a triple distinction between sacrament only, reality only, and sacramental reality. With reference to the Eucharist, then, the unconsecrated bread and wine could be considered as a sign only, or a sacramental sign. The consecrated or transubstantiated bread and wine, however, were a sacramental reality, something that was both a sacrament on the one hand and reality on the other. Their reality, after being changed by the words of the priest, was the reality of Christ himself. But the sign of that reality was not the appearance of Christ as he looked when he lived upon the earth, but the appearance of bread and wine. And that sign, the bread and wine on the altar, signified a further reality, something that was not a sign of anything else, but was, so to speak, an end in itself, namely the coming of Christ really and truly into the body and soul of the Christian who received communion with a deep faith and a devout heart. Unfortunately, however, these nuanced metaphysical explanations, true as they were to the religious experience of Christians in the Middle Ages, and faithful as they were to the scriptures as they were understood at that time, remained somewhat abstract and abstruse to the majority of people, who not only weren't devout monks and scholastic theologians, but who were largely uneducated and even illiterate. Their understanding of the Eucharist was based mainly on their own experience and on what they were told from the pulpit, namely, they experienced a real divine presence in the host and chalice that they looked at and adored, and they were told that the bread and wine had really been changed into the body and blood of Christ. And because they remained innocent of philosophical theorizing, their understanding of the Eucharist remained mostly physical rather than metaphysical. And this was true not only of the common people, but also of most of the common clergy, who had only a rudimentary education in how to perform the Mass and how to explain it to the faithful. In the later Middle Ages, therefore, pious beliefs and religious superstitions continued to infiltrate popular attitudes about the Eucharist, even as they had in the early Middle Ages. There were stories about bleeding hosts and images of Christ that appeared on the bread and wine after the consecration, and people believed that looking at the host when it was elevated at Mass would bring them good luck, prosperity in business, and safety from the temptations of the devil. In addition, the notion that the Mass itself was a sacrifice, a representation or reenactment of Christ's sacrifice on the cross, combined with the idea that Christ's sacrifice must be infinitely meritorious in the eyes of God, led to the belief that the simple performance of a Mass by a priest was equally meritorious. And since a priest could, when he said the Mass, pray to God that the spiritual merits of this Mass be applied to the soul of a particular person, the practice grew of asking priests to offer Masses not only for people who were alive, but also for the souls of people who had died, in order to release them from purgatory and gain them access to heaven. In some places, priests said a number of Masses one after another, applying the merits of each Mass to different intentions, and since then as now it was customary to give the priest an offering in exchange for his services, the offering of Masses for the living and the dead became a substantial part of clerical income. When Martin Luther, in the early 1500s, began first to question and then to attack certain church practices, he didn't question the existence or importance of the Mass, but he did attack the superstitions and the apparent buying and selling of salvation that had gotten connected with it. He believed, for one thing, that much of the superstition came from people's ignorance about what was going on during the Mass, and so as part of his own reforms, once he had been excommunicated from the Roman Church, he translated the Mass into German. He rejected the idea that the Mass was a sacrifice in the sense of being an unbloody representation of Christ's sacrifice on the cross, and he argued that the only way it could be conceivably called a sacrifice was if, during the Mass, Christians offered themselves to God. Luther's view was that the purpose of the Mass was for Christians to be spiritually nourished by the body and blood of Christ, and he therefore urged his followers to receive communion every time that they attended a Eucharistic service. As for how the bread and wine became the body and blood of Christ, Luther felt that the theory of consubstantiation, the idea that after consecration bread and wine and the body and blood are present together on the altar, was much more plausible than the theory of transubstantiation. But he also believed that most people, in fact, didn't need a philosophical explanation for what they believed in faith and experienced during Eucharistic worship. For them, it was enough to know that a real change had taken place and that what they received in communion was truly Christ's body and blood. John Calvin, on the other hand, accepted neither transubstantiation nor consubstantiation as a philosophical theory, because he didn't believe that the bread and wine changed into any other substance during a Eucharistic service. What they did become were symbols of Christ's body and blood, which had to be in heaven, if they were anywhere. And yet Calvin, like Luther, seems to have experienced a spiritual presence and power when he received communion, for he argued that when Christians receive these symbols of Christ's body and blood, they also receive strength and nourishment from God, which to the Christian is like spiritual meat and drink. Thus, Calvin believed that what Christ meant when he told his disciples to eat his body and drink his blood was not that they should receive magically transformed bread and wine, but that they should receive spiritual nourishment from him, that he should be their meat and drink. The normal way for Christians to receive this spiritual food, however, was not by watching the liturgy, but by listening to the Word of God. And so Calvin replaced the weekly Eucharist with a prayer service built around the reading and explaining of the Bible. He modified the Eucharistic service making it something that more closely resembled the early Christians' Lord's Supper, namely a simple sharing of symbolic foods, and he recommended that his followers celebrate the Lord's Supper and receive communion only a few times each year. Ulrich Zwingli represents the most radical view of the Eucharist among the early Reformers. For him, the Mass or the Lord's Supper, no matter how it was celebrated, could be no more than a memorial service. And so, if Christ's body and blood were present at all, it was present in the imaginations of Christians when they attended a Eucharistic service, imagined the incidents of the Last Supper or Christ's death on the cross. With radical views like these becoming voiced in Europe, the bishops at the Council of Trent felt it necessary to rethink and restate the Catholic position quite clearly. They did so in three separate council documents, one on the Blessed Sacrament, one on the reception of communion, and one on the Mass as a sacrifice. As to the Blessed Sacrament, the council reaffirmed the Christian belief in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, and it presented the scholastic theory of transubstantiation as the only acceptable way to explain the change from bread and wine into the Blessed Sacrament. As to the reception of Holy Communion, the bishops primarily defended the Catholic practice of people receiving only the host against the Reformers' charge that all Christians were entitled to both the host and the chalice. And as to the Mass as a sacrifice, the bishops at the council developed in a succinct and theologically coherent fashion the scholastic explanation of how and why the Mass could be understood as a sacrifice. And they did it in such a way that Catholics would have to acknowledge the primary importance of Christ's own sacrifice on the cross. Because the Mass was a sacrifice then, people didn't have to receive communion at every Mass. But, since it was a spiritual sacrifice having spiritual value, its merits could not be bought and sold in the way some Catholics were thinking they could be. As for reforming the Mass itself and the abuses that had been connected with it, however, the Council of Trent did not do much directly. Rather, it simply decreed that reform should take place, but it left the form and implementation of those reforms to the Pope and the church offices in the Vatican. Realistically speaking, there was no way that the Roman liturgists could recover and reinstate the early Christian Eucharist or the great patristic liturgy. They simply did not have the data or the historical skills needed to reconstruct what Eucharistic worship had been like that so long ago. So instead, they developed a liturgically and theologically sound model for Catholic worship based on the best that the Middle Ages had to offer and based on the scholastic understanding of the Mass and the Eucharist. And to prevent abuses from again creeping into Catholic practice and theology the way they had gotten in before the later Middle Ages, the Vatican decreed that there could be no changes in the Mass anywhere in the world without its explicit permission, and that Catholic theologians could teach no explanation for the Mass which did not agree with the teachings of the Council of Trent. As you can see, this strict regulation of both liturgical practice and sacramental theology did not encourage creative worship or creative thinking in the Catholic Church during the centuries that followed the Protestant Reformation. Whatever developments there were in theology were rather on the fringes of Catholic theology, because the central beliefs were considered by all to be doctrinally correct and theologically untouchable. Likewise, whatever developments there were in liturgical piety, as it was once called, occurred on the fringes of Eucharistic worship. There were no noticeable changes in the Mass for almost 400 years. But there were some other developments, such as increased devotion to Christ in the Blessed Sacrament during the 18th century and more frequent reception of communion during the early part of the 20th century. Whatever changes were occurring that would eventually affect the Catholic practice and understanding of Eucharistic worship were taking place outside the Vatican offices and even outside the Church itself. In Germany at first, and later in France and Belgium, some Benedictine monks in the 19th century began to dig through the ancient archives of liturgical texts to get a better understanding of the Mass and its history. And with that, the liturgical movement was born, which eventually resulted in the changes of the 1960s and 70s. In non-Catholic universities, new philosophies were being developed, which would eventually provide intellectual frameworks other than scholasticism for understanding not only the Mass and the sacraments, but for interpreting the whole of Christian theology. Most Catholics, however, including those of us who grew up in the Church before the Second Vatican Council, had little idea of what was going on behind the scenes. All we are familiar with are those things which have come into the spotlight during the past 20 years or so, such as changes in the liturgy and changes in sacramental theology. The changes in the liturgy are on the one hand obvious to those who live through them, and on the other hand, they are far too numerous to describe them to people who don't know the old liturgy. Suffice it to say that the historical research, which had been going on for decades, the liturgical movement which was promoting greater lay participation in the Mass, and the pastoral concern of bishops to make the liturgy more meaningful to the people, led the bishops of the Second Vatican Council to ask for changes in the Mass which would enhance public worship and which would have some precedent in the periods of liturgical history prior to the Middle Ages. At the risk of oversimplification, one could say that what the Liturgical Commission did in its revision of the Mass was return to the liturgical ideals of the patristic period and adapt them to the needs of the contemporary church. Thus, the Mass was translated into the language of the people. The altar was taken away from the back wall, and the priest was asked to celebrate the liturgy facing the people. Many of the Mass prayers which had gotten added during the Middle Ages were taken out, and elements such as the penitential rite, the responsorial psalm, and the Alleluia verse were given added emphasis. The importance of the sermon or homily was re-emphasized, and, perhaps more importantly, the people themselves were encouraged and even expected to pray out loud and to join in the singing during liturgical worship. Most Catholics were also happy that liturgies could be celebrated in informal settings, such as homes, in classrooms, in parks, when the occasion was right for them. And church music underwent a dramatic revolution in the 1960s and 70s from being Gregorian chant and pious hymns to being more modern music in a variety of styles. These changes in Eucharistic practice have, of course, engendered changes in Eucharistic theology, though, to some extent, changes in theology, even before the Vatican Council, were already instrumental in suggesting changes in the liturgy itself. Most of the developments in Eucharistic theology, however, have taken place during the 1960s and 70s. And, for the sake of convenience, we may divide them into, first of all, changes in the understanding of the sacramental action or liturgy, secondly, changes in the understanding of the sacramental object, or the consecrated bread and wine, and thirdly, changes in the understanding of both of these taken together. First of all, then, the change in the understanding of the sacramental action was basically a movement away from the idea that the Mass was a sacrifice to the idea that it is a sacred meal. This shift in thinking had already begun to take place before the liturgical changes were made, and in fact, this shift in thinking was the motivation for some of the liturgical changes, such as the moving of the altar to a more central place in the sanctuary. Even though there are still prayers in the revised liturgy, therefore, which refer to the liturgy as a sacrifice, the actual thinking of theologians and ordinary Catholics has tended to bypass those concepts and to focus on communion as the sharing of a meal. The practical result of this has been a great increase over the past 20 years in the number of people who go to communion every Sunday. And the theological result of this has been a broadening of the theological focus from what goes on at the moment of consecration to what is happening during the entire liturgy for the Christian community which celebrates what it is with a ritual meal, during which the people both share and become the body of Christ. Secondly, the change in the understanding of the sacramental object or the consecrated bread and wine, was, going along with this change in the understanding of the sacramental action, basically a shift away from seeing them as things in themselves to seeing them as things within a larger context, namely the context of Christian worship and the sharing of a communal meal. Whereas the shift from the Mass as a sacrifice to the Mass as a meal had been prompted mainly by liturgical and scriptural considerations, the movement away from transubstantiation to other explanations of the consecration resulted primarily from the fact that contemporary theologians were no longer using scholasticism as their basic intellectual framework, and so they looked for other philosophical explanations of what was going on which was different from the explanation which the theory of transubstantiation offered. But since transubstantiation had practically become a Christian doctrine itself in the eyes of many bishops, priests, and laypeople, the theologians who offered new explanations of the Eucharist had to be careful to assure their readers that what they were saying was not contradictory to the theory of transubstantiation, but was merely different from the older philosophical theory. The modern theory which has enjoyed the widest popularity is called transsignification. It is rooted in the phenomenological theory of symbolism used by Karl Rahner and Edward Skillebeck, and it recognizes the fact that many human actions have more than one possible meaning or significance, and that the significance of an action is a part of its reality. So, for example, a kiss is usually a sign of affection, and so giving a kiss most often is a sign or a symbol of real love or friendship. The famous kiss that Judas gave to Jesus, however, had a quite different meaning. It was a signal to the soldiers which told them which man in the Garden of Gethsemane that they were supposed to arrest. So that kiss, far from being an act of affection, was really an act of betrayal. In other words, by changing the signification of the action, Judas had changed the reality of the action. Now, a kiss is purely an action, but many actions that we perform involve the use of things or objects which get taken up, so to speak, into the reality of the whole action itself. Again, to give a rather prosaic example, when I use a 5-iron to play golf, it is, in that activity, a piece of sports equipment. But should I grab it in a fit of anger to attack and hit somebody with it, that action changes it in that situation from being a piece of sports equipment to being a weapon. So here, the significance of the action has changed the reality of an object, which is a part of that action, even though, as you can see, it hasn't changed the outward appearance of that object. That is, it still looks like a 5-iron. What the proponents of this theory of transignification propose, therefore, is that Jesus, at the Last Supper, changed the significance of the bread and the wine that he shared with his disciples, and, in so doing, he changed their reality from being mere food and drink to being his body and blood. In a similar way, when a priest at Mass says the words of Christ, "This is my body, this is my blood," the significance of those sacramental objects, and hence their reality, is changed, even though they still look like ordinary bread and wine. In other words, Jesus, within the context of a meal, changed the meaning, and therefore the reality, of the bread and wine for his disciples. In a similar way, within the context of the sacred meal known as the Eucharistic Liturgy, through the words of consecration, the meaning, and therefore the reality of the bread and wine, is changed from being ordinary food to being Christ himself for those who have faith and receive communion with the intention of encountering the risen Lord. Thus, in recent sacramental theology, theologians suggest that it is a mistake to discuss the reality of the sacred objects, the bread and the wine, apart from the reality of the sacramental action, which is liturgical worship. It is in the context of such worship that the reality of the bread and wine is changed for the believers. And by extension, it is in the context of non-liturgical worship, such as public exposition of the Blessed Sacrament, or even private visits to a chapel where the sacrament is reserved, it is in the context of such prayer and worship that the consecrated sacrament is a sign of Christ's presence and is therefore a symbol through which his presence is truly experienced. In summary, then, we can say that in today's church, Catholic theologians and lay Catholics alike are re-examining and rethinking the meaning and the reality of the Eucharist, both in the sense of its being a liturgical or sacramental action, and in the sense of its being a sacramental object, which is found on the altar, received at Mass, and reserved in the tabernacle. As Catholics, we are trying to come to an understanding of Eucharist which is both faithful to our religious heritage and faithful to our religious experience. And, since the Second Vatican Council at least, we are becoming more willing to give ourselves permission, so to speak, to develop an understanding of Eucharist which might be different in wording from the formulations of the recent past, but which is nonetheless authentically Catholic because it embraces all 20 centuries of the Catholic liturgical tradition, and because it authentically describes our contemporary experience of Eucharistic worship.